Okay, I'd like to talk to you about some experiments we did a couple of years ago, and in fact, most of the work is published at this point, although some details are yet to be put in print. Convection in the presence of a phase transition. Now, that has, in some remote sense, some relation to what goes on in clouds, so I thought it might be worth talking about it during this week. But it is perfectly clear that there are some very important differences between what happens in clouds and what happens in this system. There are several things one can enumerate. We have strong thermal gradients here, and the rain actually forms in a very thin thermal boundary layer rather than in the bulk. And there's no air present, right? There's just a single component with two phases. And there are probably other differences. But it's worth perhaps having a look at this. So we have a typical Rayleigh-Binet system, which we are all familiar with, I think. One of the parameters to be controlled is the mean temperature of the sample, the average between the bottom and the top. And there will be an applied temperature difference, which will be held constant during a sequence of measurements as a function of Tm. Aspect ratio is 1. The fluid is ethane at various pressures. And at various different pressures, the phase transition temperature between liquid and vapor will be different. In the single phase region, we have the usual relation between the Nusselt and Rayleigh number with an effective exponent near 0.31. So that's the system. And now in the pressure temperature plane, we will move along isobars, along those dashed lines. And I guess I have the option to use this, right? I would if. Huh? No, it doesn't work.
It will work.
Huh?
No.
Now it works. Oh, you have to turn it on.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we have in the pressure temperature plane, here's the phase transition temperature, which I call T sub phi. And we move along isobars, the dashed lines. And the temperature difference across the sample is indicated schematically by this red line. And as we are way on the right, we are in the single phase, and then we move in here, and the thermodynamic transition will be somewhere in the temperature difference that is applied to the sample, and then we come out on the other side again in the single phase liquid region. And so we have to now consider what the temperature variation, the vertical temperature variation, is in a turbulent Rayleigh-Binet system, and that is illustrated here by some of the beautiful data from Ketching Shaw's lab, where we have T minus T top as a function of height in the sample, Z, and you see there's a thermal boundary layer, and then there's a nearly uniform temperature in the bulk. And the thermal boundary layer is really quite thin compared to the whole sample length. If we now move along here far enough so that the T sub phi is about somewhere close to the middle of the sample, well, let's say it's located about here, then there's a thin layer here, part of the thermal boundary layer, that is thermodynamically metastable and that potentially can form rain or drops. As we move with the mean temperature further to the left, this will slide up, and eventually we get to the point where instead of having vapor in the sample, the entire sample will fill with liquid. It comes at a particular point. The entire thing forms with liquid, and then you can start having boiling at the bottom. So both of these processes can take place. So I will first focus on this situation where we will develop a thin, metastable vapor layer at the top, right? Because the rest is all vapor, and we are now developing a metastable vapor layer that can, in principle, form liquid drops, and it's that process that you saw taking place here, where you see these dark things, they are drops of liquid forming.
How big is the drop size when they compare?
The drop size? It is large, but you have to be careful because there could be some distortion in the shadow graph technique. This is all visualized by looking at lateral density variations averaged over the sample height by the shadow graph method. And I really don't trust the the measurements of the drop diameters very well. But putting that aside, if I do measure it, it's about 3 millimeters out of a sample diameter of 100 millimeters. Okay, and the
conductivity of the liquid is much, much higher than that of the gas.
The thermal conductivity of the quiescent liquid?
Well, of the condensed phase.
Not that much. They will become equal at the critical point. Right, and so they are, yes? Yeah.
The wind is basically the gas phase, the wind.
What about the wind?
It's
sweeping the drops along from left to right.
That's the gas, that's the liquid, that's the wind phase. It's really like wind.
That's right, it's in the vapor phase.
And it's now for sort of a force to sweep the liquid.
You have to understand we're working not too far from the critical point where the vapor and liquid have comparable densities. The densities may only differ by 10 or 20%. Okay?
It's not like no.
It's a very powerful wind. Okay. Let's see. So now what do we get? Okay, we're done with that. You see, effective conductivity in watts per centimeter Kelvin is a function of the mean temperature. And here are the phase transition temperatures, okay? Well, the thermodynamic transition temperatures, right? Liquid is stable to the left, and vapor is stable to the right. And in between, you can, in principle, have a two-phase system. Right? Now, over here, we're in the single-phase system, pure vapor, and the Nusselt number here already is very large, right? It's single phase, but the Nusselt number is the Rayleigh number is in the 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 13 range, okay? And similarly here in the liquid, we also have a high Rayleigh number and therefore a high Nusselt number. And you see they are roughly comparable. I mean, they're not that different, right? But at this point, there's a clear enhancement of the heat transport. And that enhancement is due to the droplet formation in the top boundary layer, to the rain coming down. Now, the raindrops that form at the top, of course, have a higher density and presumably will settle. It's not clear that they survive to the bottom. In fact, if they drop slowly enough, they will not survive. They will evaporate again. But they will nonetheless contribute to the heat transport. In this region, where we have vapor with liquid droplets, the data are completely reproducible, and it doesn't matter whether we go this way or whether we come from here and go that way. The open triangles are going in one direction, the solid ones are going in the other direction. You get always exactly the same answer. Then comes a point here where something catastrophic happens. And in fact, what happens at this point, if you go beyond it, is that the entire sample fills with liquid. This is done at constant pressure, right? So we have an external pressure regulation system that is able to supply more material, right? So at that point, we're over here, the system says, I've had enough of being full of vapor, I want to get full of liquid, and it just fills up. Of course, you have to wait till that process takes place, right? And then over here, all of this is with the sample in the liquid phase, and with boiling at the bottom. And this is highly irreproducible. We get fluctuations indicated by this. This is not an error bar. This is the range over which the heat transport fluctuates in time, and you do the experiment several times. You get different answers. completely irreproducible. So that's the basic situation. And I want to define a fraction, a metastable or unstable liquid temperature fraction, right, which is the phase transition temperature minus T top over delta T. I will use that. And for these measurements, delta T was 1 degree, but there were measurements with many different temperature differences. Now, what do we see? Well, we see the shadowgraph methods. We see these various pictures. This is in the vapor phase, and all we see here is the usual plumes that we know about that form, and it's really single phase. Then we go a little bit, just barely into this region here, right, into there, and we start getting the liquid droplets. And as we go deeper into that region, we get more and more liquid drops. And then as we drop out over here and fill the sample with liquid, it looks like there's nothing happening anymore, but there are occasional black dots here, and they are vapor bubbles that form at the bottom. And as you go deeper into here, these vapor bubbles actually are able to rise and survive all the way to the top, accumulate at the top, and make one big bubble. And actually, inside that big bubble, you have rain again. You have the liquid coming down. So this is a very complicated regime. And from the physics point of view, I don't find it so appealing because you can't measure anything that's reproducible. I think basically what it boils down to is that here we have homogeneous nucleation, which is highly reproducible. And here I suspect the vapor bubbles are formed through heterogeneous nucleation, and that is not reproducible from one run to the next. We can look at this in the form of movies. This is in the single phase region, right here, and all you have is the plumes and the last gate circulation driving them around. Then we go a little bit into the two phase region, and that's something like this is what you saw on the first slide. You see the liquid drops forming and meandering over here, driven by the large-scale circulation. And when we go on this side, over here, you see that these little vapor bubbles, they form, and they are also swept around, but there are very few of them. That's why the heat transport is not enhanced very much. And when we go up there a little further, we get this complicated situation, which may be amusing, but no, he doesn't like it. So you see this big vapor bubble forming at the top with rain forming inside it, and these little guys here, they form at the bottom and they feed into this thing. So having seen roughly what happens, let's look at some of the numbers. Here we have the effective conductivity as a function of T top minus T phi, the distance of the top temperature from the phase transition temperature. And so at zero, that means that the temperature difference has been moved over just to the point where the top temperature is at the phase transition temperature. We're just entering the potential two-phase region. And if you look at these diamonds, you see nothing happens there. And something happens a little bit later at a temperature which I called T top on. That's where the onset of the heat transport enhancement is. And so the onset does not occur at T phi, it occurs below it. What that means is that you must first form a metastable layer of vapor in the top boundary layer of finite thickness before you can have droplet formation. And you cannot see it so well for the other temperature differences here because of the scale of this. But if you look at T phi minus T top on here as a function of delta T, you see that these points all fall in a straight line. And that sort of suggests that I shall plot this here against the reduced variable where T phi minus T top is divided by delta T, right, this temperature fraction phi. When I plot all the data, these data and other data, additional data are included, they all fall on a universal line, and there is a break from the single phase behavior at a very specific point along that that coordinate. And that is that 1 minus phi on equals 0.05. You can read it off this graph, it's 0.05. And that means that at that point, the thickness of the metastable vapor layer has grown up to 0.1 times the thermal boundary layer. Because in this region, the temperature gradient in the sample is constant, right? And so we are 10% into the boundary layer. Well, if we are 10% into the boundary layer, we know how thick the thermal boundary layer is. We can figure out that a metastable layer of thickness 12 micrometers is required before rain can form. Right? Now, exactly why that is, I think, is somewhat of an open issue. We all know that in homogeneous nucleation, droplets have to be of a certain size before they can grow, and if they're smaller than that, they will decay. But I think this tends to be a little bit larger than what one would estimate for that. But of course, it's very dangerous to, you know, think about this problem in terms of homogeneous nucleation theory, which is made for a metastable, thermally uniform sample of fluid, and not for a sample of fluid with a very steep thermal gradient in it that is also undergoing turbulent convection. Right? Nonetheless, that's all we have for comparison. And so I think this is related to that issue. Yeah. Well, I'm happy with local thermodynamic equilibrium. I mean, I think that's not a no problem. But nonetheless, you calculate the free energy of a droplet, including the surface tension, at a uniform temperature. And now you have a steep thermal gradient, including a gradient across the droplet, and it obviously gets much more complicated. I mean, it would be nice to extend nucleation theory to this more complicated situation, and perhaps that can be done. Right? But it's beyond what we wanted to tackle. That's why I'm saying it is homogeneous nucleation. There are no aerosols, and I have other reasons to believe, which I will tell you about, that it is homogeneous nucleation. And homogeneous nucleation, a droplet forms as a spontaneous density fluctuation due to the fact that the system is sitting at finite temperature. It's a KT effect. Yeah. No, that's not what happens. Films don't grow. That's not energetically favorable. Droplets form in the boundary layer, in the thermal boundary layer. And not on the plate. I cannot be sure from direct experimental observation. I believe they form in the gas phase and not on the substrate.
Then you can try to estimate.
But I cannot, I don't have an experimental observation that shows you that the droplet forms in the gas. I have to infer that from other evidence.
If it's 12 microns, it's pretty strong evidence that it's forming on the plate. It's basically nucleation on the.
I don't think so. I don't think it is evidence for that at all.
It could be with its large,
you see,
it's also falling, not only because of the temperature gradient, but when you do it homogeneous, equilibrium, you assume that you have all the time in the world for droplet to grow. It could be infinitely slow. Now it couldn't because it's falling, and it's leaving its temperature when it starts to fall. And And that would require a larger size of the droplet. There might be this phenomenon that it's unstationary.
Okay? Yeah.
The droplets are created there, but they
move
down,
yeah.
And they leave the phase.
Yeah,
of
yeah.
But that you can ask me.
Droplets have a large temperature.
Yeah.
So, Marangoni effect will may not play a role, but there's a strong connection in the sky.
It's entirely possible. Entirely possible. I don't know. One would have to make some kind of an estimate of that. Yeah. Now, you see, you have to have the 12 micron layer because you have to have a metastable layer that is thick enough for a droplet of sufficiently large size to even form in the bulk. Right? The bulk has to be thick enough because a droplet of too small a diameter is going to collapse again in homogeneous nucleation. Right. I think that's correct. It's what? No. Not in homogeneous nucleation. And also, I think your intuition would probably fail you because the fluid parameters here are totally different from what you're normally used to. You know, it's not like water. So one has to really make an estimate, but the droplet size, the critical droplet size, is much bigger than nanometers. It's micrometers. And you know, for the system with a homogeneous temperature, you can estimate it from homogeneous nucleation theory, and I should know the number, but I don't. But it's not hard to estimate. You know, you need to know how the surface tension behaves, and you need to know what the free energy difference between the droplets. Hey, what are we here with you? That wasn't supposed to happen. Sorry about that. from this catching, from this temperature shift, right? We have to know. Let's see. Where do I go here? We go to your data, right? And I know that the temperature shift is a certain amount, right, this much, right, before droplets form. And I can now see, I mean, it's a certain amount this way. Now I can see, I can look at your data, and I can look here how thick the metastable part is, right, because I know the temperature gradient in the boundary layer. Right? Of course, I have to use not your data for that. I have to use it, you know, the properties or the what I know about the boundary layer on this system. Well, we still have the gas here.
And so this layer does look to this possibility.
We still have the vapor here, right? There are only little droplets, a few droplets start to form here, right? But the boundary layer is still the vapor boundary layer. I won't have any time left for, the other thing, I'll go fast here. It turns out, you know, these guys take off with different slopes here. When you plot lambda effective, the slope be depending on the applied temperature difference. But if you look at the actual heat current that is carried, right, if you take lambda effective and multiply it by delta T, then you get a universal curve up here. But of course, these guys, you know, where they come in here, is now they're all different, right? So the heat current here in the single phase region depends strongly on the applied temperature difference, but the effective conductivity does not, as you can see here. That's because the Rayleigh number doesn't change that much. Let me look now at these data on a much more crude temperature scale. These are data now at different pressures, right, on different isobars. And this is the critical pressure, or the critical temperature. We're looking on the temperature axis. And here we're above the critical temperature. Now, I can estimate what the turbulent heat transport would be by extrapolating Grossmann-Loser or something into this parameter range. And for instance, above the critical point, we have these data, right, these circles, and you have a maximum of the heat transport on the critical isochore, but there's no phase transition above the critical point. And the solid line is estimated, is the estimated heat transport based on Grossmann-Lose. So this is all quite consistent with single phase convection here. And now in the two phase region, we'll make the same estimate of the single phase heat transport, and it's these little solid lines. And now we'll look at the difference between the peak of that estimate and the measured peak. And that's the extra heat transport, the extra maximum heat transport in the two-phase system, right? And those data are plotted here, delta lambda star, as a function of, I've chosen epsilon p as some measure of the distance from the critical point, right? Epsilon p is 1 minus p over pc. And the solid line is a fit of the data by a power law, gives an exponent of minus 1.1, but the red line is an exponential fit, and both, you know, we can't tell the difference, obviously. The data aren't good enough. But from nucleation theory, you would expect an exponential behavior, see, because you have e to the minus delta f over kt, where delta f is the difference in free energy between the two systems, and delta f goes to zero at the critical point, and so you have this exponential goes to one. But it has a prefactor, a, and A also goes to zero at the critical point, but it goes to zero algebraically, okay? So you would expect the exponential to dominate here, but then, according to nucleation theory, this should turn over and come down again. Right. But this is the nucleation rate. Now, the other important parameter, of course, is the latent heat, right? You make a drop, and a drop carries a certain amount of heat with it, which is due to the latent heat, the difference in free energy of the two phases. But the heat current is not only determined by the latent heat, it's also determined by the rate at which you form droplets, right? And this is the nucleation rate that I discussed here. And the latent heat goes to zero as well. So at first it was a big surprise that, you know, these peaks increased as we approached a critical point, because everything has to go to zero at this point, or has to go to this background value, right? We decided we had better make some more measurements closer to the critical point. And now here we have some of these delta lambdas, right? Here we are out 1% away. You know, 1% away would be here, right? 0.01, right? So this right here would correspond to about this here to the right, right? And lo and behold, when you go in closer, the peaks go down again. Okay, so consistent with this simple picture of homogeneous nucleation, we have first an exponential increase. We have something consistent with an exponential increase, and then a algebraic decrease in this regime. So that qualitatively, that behavior is consistent with homogeneous nucleation theory, and that is one of the features that suggests that indeed the nucleation is homogeneous. And that's really all I have to say. And should we have questions now? Or let. Let's wait till later. Stefan is now going to talk about a slightly different topic, which is perhaps even more remotely related to rain and clouds, but it does involve first sort of phase transition. And you have to be properly equipped now.
I think it works good. Okay. This talk is about thermal convection in pneumatic liquid crystals. And this is also slightly related to the talk Gunther just gave, because also here we have a phase transition, and also here we make experiments where the phase transition between the pneumatic phase and the isotropic phase occurs. Let me just remind you what a pneumatic liquid crystal is. It's a fluid that consists of molecules with a preferred axis, and these molecules interact with each other in the way that the axes are aligned parallel to each other. And if you consider, of course, you don't consider the molecules. You consider in a continuum theory something called the director, which is the average over a bunch of molecules. And you have a field of this director, which tells you in which direction the molecules are aligned. And the interaction between these molecules is very small. And therefore, if you increase the temperature, the thermal fluctuations become large and might destroy the interaction between the molecules and turn, at a certain temperature, the pneumatic liquid crystal into a normal fluid. And this transition point is also called the clearing point, because the pneumatic phase looks white, like milk. And then if the alignment does not exist anymore, then the isotropic phase turns transparent, like water. And the interesting thing about these pneumatic liquid crystals is that they have, because of their orientation, they have anisotropic properties of, Okay, and here we see some measurements of some anisotropic properties, for example, the heat conductivity. This is, by the way, our liquid crystal. We use pentyl cyano biphenyl. It's an elongated molecule. And the heat conductivity is different perpendicular to the director and then parallel to the director. So in the parallel, the heat conductivity is larger than in perpendicular. And this difference becomes smaller when you come when you increase the temperature and come close to the clearing point. And then above the clearing point, you have the isotropic phase, and it behaves like a normal fluid with only one heat conductivity. Here, this dashed line is just the averaged heat conductivity. If you have a big sample of liquid crystals and they are aligned on a small domain, but in big samples, you have all alignments possible, and then they average to basically this line. Of course, you have to take into consideration that you have twice the perpendicular heat conductivity and only once the parallel one. This plot shows you the density in the pneumatic and the isotropic phase. And it's interesting that the phase transition between the pneumatic and isotropic phase is very weak, in a sense that the density jumps here only very little. I mean, it's almost not visible here. It looks like a kink, like a first, like a second order phase transition. But if you look exactly at the densities, you see the jump is only 0.1% in density. And therefore, it's a very, very weak phase transition, and not like between a gas or and a liquid. Okay, this is our apparatus. We have a cylindrical convection cell, which has gamma aspect ratio gamma 1/2. It's 19 centimeters high, 9.5 centimeters in diameter. And it's in this apparatus. The bottom plate is heated by a film heater. The top plate is cooled by the water that's built on the top plate, and it's basically the cell, the sidewall is insulated from these cooling fluids. So we have the Rayleigh number, we have the Nusselt number, and the Brundle number. However, I want to point out that the thermal diffusivity is calculated by the average of the heat conductivity. And another parameter, which is a little bit complicated, is to choose the right viscosity. And we choose this fourth Leslie coefficient. These Leslie coefficients, they're coefficients that appear in the stress tensor of the Navier-Stokes equation. And there is one of them, you have six Leslie coefficients, and one of them is not related to a term that couples the director orientation to the velocity field. And therefore, if you go from the pneumatic into the isotropic phase, this is the only Leslie parameter that still survives and exists, and therefore, it's the viscosity we choose. So this is the Brundle number. I just show you this plot as a function of the temperature. I just show you this plot in order to show how strong the Brundle number changes if you change the temperature very little. So even if you apply an experiment where you have rather small temperature difference, you always are in the non-Boussinesq regime, because the fluid properties change very significant. This temperature. So just very short, these are some normal experiments. Plotted is the reduced Nusselt number as a function of the Rayleigh number. The red squares are for our fluid in the enigmatic phase. The green and blue symbols, they are experiments for triethylene glycol, an isotropic fluid, which are very similar Brundle number. And you see they give pretty similar results. I mean, the model of Grossmann-Lose in this case is quite different. But the reason is, as I will show you later, that one possible reason is this Grossmann-Lose theory assumes a fully turbulent system. And this is not yet the case. I mean, the Rayleigh number is pretty large, but also the Brundle number is pretty large. And therefore, the onset to the full developed turbulence occurs at very large Brundle number, Rayleigh number. So what we can do, we have some magnets. And so we can create a field in vertical direction in order to align the director. These plots just should show you that the variation of the magnetic field is rather small over the volume of our cell. And here are actual measurements. I don't plot the Nusselt number anymore, but rather the effective heat conductivity defined by our heat input in the bottom plate and, of course, scaled by the average temperature gradient. And you see, well, it's also scaled by the effective heat conductivity without a magnetic field. And you see, if you apply and increase the magnetic field, the effective heat conductivity increases. And this effect is larger for small temperature differences and smaller for large temperature differences. And in order to check whether this is maybe only a problem with our experiment or whether this is real, we did the same experiment for the isotropic phase. So we increased the temperature, the average temperature, so that the whole cylinder is filled with the transparent isotropic fluid. Sorry? The director is usually aligns in the direction of the magnetic field. Okay, I will say something in the next slide. I just plotted this red line, or the red points. They are the same experiment in the isotropic phase. And here you see that the magnetic field, as expected, has no influence on the heat conductivity. So now the question is, why do we have an increase of the heat transport? And well, we don't know, but we can make some estimations. And Malkus suggested more than 50 years ago that if you have a convection cell and it's fully turbulent, you can consider it as in a pretty simple way, you say you have a bulk region where the temperature is constant, and you have thermal boundary layers at the top and at the bottom, where you have a very steep temperature gradient, and the thickness of the thermal boundary layers is in the way that these layers can be represented as marginal stable convection cells. And within these thermal boundary layers, the heat is only transported by conduction, and the fluid motion doesn't play a big role. So you can write down, you have a critical Rayleigh number. You just write it down in this way, where you assume the height is the width of the thermal boundary layer. And then you see that the width of the thermal boundary layer is proportional to lambda to the 1/3. So the lambda is the heat conductivity. And as I said also, all the heat is transported solely by conduction and not by fluid motion. And if you plug this into our formula for the effective heat conductivity, you see that the measured heat conductivity goes with the heat conductivity of the fluid to the power 2/3. So now if we just can check whether our effect, the increase of the heat transport, is only because we align the director and therefore we increase the heat conductivity of the fluid. We can plug in some numbers here. Without the magnetic field, we have the average heat conductivity of the fluid represented like this. And if we have a very strong magnetic field, infinitely strong, all the molecules, all the directors are aligned vertical, or parallel to the magnetic field, vertical. parallel to the cell axis. Then we have a heat conductivity of the fluid that is lambda parallel. So we can calculate the ratio to the power of 2/3, and we get 1.23. So it means, regarding this model, if we align all the director in vertical direction, we would have a 1.23 times higher heat conductivity than without the magnetic field. As you see here, our maximum value is 1.1, so 10% increase for 2K. So this, first of all, might mean that not all directors are aligned yet. But on the other hand, you also would expect that if you go to very large magnetic field, you will get a saturation, which we don't see here yet. I mean, this is maybe we are not high at the magnetic field, or something is not correct with the model. I mean, it's a very simplified version. But let me give you some numbers. For one experiment I showed you before, at 8 Kelvin temperature difference, we have Rayleigh numbers of 2 times 10 to the 8, gives a Russell number, a Nusselt number of about 40. And so we can estimate the thickness of the thermal boundary layers, and they are, in our case, around 2.4 millimeters. And then we can estimate a value for the Fredericks field, which is turns out to be around 30 Gauss. So Fredericks field, what is this? It just means that if I have two plates and I have our molecules prepared, or the plates are prepared, that the molecules are perfectly aligned in the direction parallel to the plates, very close to the plate, how big must the magnetic field be in order to flip the director within these two plates? Yeah, I mean, because the directors want to be aligned. If they are aligned like this at the top and the bottom plate, there's one force to keep the alignment, and the other force is the magnetic field. And you have to have at least a field like this in order to start to align them a little bit. Which, I mean, if you, now, of course, you want to compare this field to our fields we had. Just in order to remind you, we were up to 500 Gauss here, and the Fredericks field is close to 30 Gauss. So it means, from this estimation at least, you would expect that most of the director, most of the molecule are already aligned with the magnetic field at such high fields of 500 Gauss. Another interesting estimate is the coherence length, which can be estimated over the Brundle number, the Rayleigh number, and the Nusselt number. And the coherence length in our system is only 0.63, or it's very high, is almost as large as the whole system, which just tells us that the system has not developed a fully turbulent state. So, and this is might be a problem with the whole, if you want to consider the system. So we don't have fully turbulence here. Okay. I plotted in the previous plot already these lines here. What are these? These are fitted parabolas like this, and you see they fit very well. But the interesting thing is that A, the coefficient, depends on the temperature difference. You see it's smaller for large temperature differences, and we can also plot this coefficient A as a function of the temperature difference, and you see it follows very nicely a power law. I mean, here's the double logarithmic plot, you also see it much better. And the exponent of this power law is 0.74, or 0.744, which looks very close to 3/4. So maybe there is a very simple scaling we can find out. Okay, now I want to come to actually experiments where a transition between the pneumatic and the isotropic phase takes place. Hope it works. I mean, this is not really an experiment, I have to say. It is before I put the cell into our apparatus, I had it outside, I heated up above the clearing point so that the whole sample was clear. And then I applied something cold on the top plate. And what you see, that the top plate now is colder than the clearing point, and you create plumes, pneumatic plumes, they drop down into the isotropic phase. I think it's a pretty nice video. It's a little bit distorted because you look from below into the bottom part of the top plate. But you see very nicely these plumes. I mean, they are, because of the light scattering, white, and the isotropic phase is clear. Okay. But now let's put the cell into our experiment and make some measurements. It's very simple to Gunther's measurement. We have a temperature difference, and then we change the average temperature between the top and the bottom plate. So in this regime, the whole cell is filled with the nematic phase, and we have convection within the nematic phase. If we enter the regime between these two lines, then the bottom plate is warmer than the clearing point, and the top plate is colder than the clearing point. So we have a phase transition inside our convection. And then if you leave this, if you cross that line to the right, you only have the isotropic phase. And also here you see, very similar to in the previous talk, a strong increase of the heat transport. And then, of course, well, and then a decrease again. And the question is, where does this increase come from? I mean, most of people would say, yeah, it's latent heat. And it might be true. If we look how large the latent heat is, we have to see it's very small, 1.5 kilojoule per kilogram. And if you just, for comparison, I also plot the latent heat of water to water vapor, this is something 2,200 kilojoule per kilogram. So the latent heat is very small and contributes very small. And if you do the same experiment with different temperature differences, you see something interesting. First of all, if you're only in the nematic phase, as expected, small temperature difference has a smaller heat contact, a smaller heat transport than if you have large temperature difference. Everything's all right. But if you go to in the regime where the phase transition occurs, and you go to the maximum of this phase transition, they have always the same value. Doesn't matter whether you have 1 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin, or 6 Kelvin. Let's zoom in here a little bit in this regime, this region close to the maximum. And here I also plotted experiment where the temperature difference was 4 Kelvin. And you see the value are pretty much always the same. So I don't know why this is the case. Maybe there's if it would be only the latent heat, you would expect that the latent heat comes on top of this basic level somehow, and you would not expect that the maximum have the same value. So I don't know why this is. We also did experiments where we then applied a magnetic field. I mean, I have to say, these are very recent experiments, preliminary results, and the last points I actually just got this week. But here's interesting, the red curve are without the magnetic field, the blue with the magnetic field. As expected in the nematic phase, an applied magnetic field leads to a larger heat transport. And also as expected, if you're in the isotropic phase, the heat transport is independent of the applied magnetic field. But something interesting happens here if you go down. Here actually, if you have a magnetic field, it's always the heat transport is a little bit reduced. I don't know whether this is real. I maybe have to repeat this experiment in order to see whether it was not just a shift by the time. But it might be something interesting that goes on there. OK, let me formulate, instead of a summary, some open questions. What maybe also we can discuss, or maybe you have some suggestions. In ongoing experiments, I want to find out what causes this heat transport enhancement when you apply magnetic field. Then also, how does the magnetic field influence the heat flow? I mean, right now I only focused on the thermal boundary layers, but it also might have some impact on the heat flow in the bulk. Does it in a way stabilizes or destabilizes the thermal boundary layers? Then we also want to apply a horizontal magnetic field, because then you would expect, if the model I showed you, that it only depends because you change the fluid properties, you only change the heat conductivity of the fluid. If you would apply a horizontal magnetic field, you would lower the heat conductivity or the heat transport. So that's what we want to try. And then one important question in these experiments of convection under phase transition is, what is the reason for the heat transport enhancement? What is the role of the latent heat, and what is whether stabilization or destabilization of the boundary layer actually plays a role? I mean, it's an interesting question because this phase transition takes part in a boundary layer close to the bottom plate or close to the top plate, and it very likely destroys or changes at least the characteristics of the thermal boundary layers. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Seems to me that closing the door actually did wonders to the cooling system. It's not blowing as much anymore.
Yeah.
But thank you. No, we'll leave it closed. I think it's better. It's not as cool. Questions? But did I understand correctly? So what you're saying is, no matter what temperature difference, we use a certain range of temperature differences. And at this point where the phase transition, basically right at the phase transition temperature, of the mean temperature, right? When you plot it there with
right,
the mean temperature.
Right, right, right.
So when the mean temperature is at the phase transition temperature, you've got the same heat flux?
No, the same
effective
heat conductivity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's
I mean, the heat, it is already...
It's the same
right,
conductivity.
Right.
So it was universal. It's completely independent of...
Yeah.
In that range of temperatures, it doesn't
yes,
matter.
I mean, if you change from 1 Kelvin to 8 Kelvin,
yeah, it,
yeah, you get more heat through it,
but the conductivity is the same.
Yes. Yeah.
But only there.
Only there, yeah.
Do you have a conjecture why that is?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know. I think maybe it has more something to do with the stability of the boundary layer, that instead of having warm pneumatic plumes in the pneumatic phase, you always have only what plays a role is warm isotropic plumes in a pneumatic phase, and I don't know. Well,
yeah, you're coming from the pneumatic. Well, on the left side it's pneumatic phase, on the right side it's isotropic.
On the right side it's isotropic. I mean, where the maximum is, this is somewhere between. I mean, actually, the maximum point is very likely that the cell is filled with pneumatic, and you have a small. The plumes come in the isotropic.
Plot, where's the bottom? For one of these, where's the bottom dead temperature and where's the top dead temperature located in the plot? You know this peak? Yeah, go back.
Maybe you see it here.
Yeah, what's the temperature? Oh, the lines actually show you where the...
Well, the lines show... I mean, this difference is 6 Kelvin and the temperature difference
so
of the experiment.
The peak,
so if you go from here above the line, you create... If you sit exactly at this line, this means that the top, the bottom plate temperature has the clearing point temperature.
Okay.
So this line, yeah? And this line is that the
so
top plate is clearing.
I have to imagine that there's a 6 Kelvin
yes.
bar that's moving.
Exactly.
This light and rigid
exactly.
At time.
Yeah.
A little louder. The question was whether FA is the same that you also observed in the Brady number. I don't know the answer to that.
You define the Brady number to be independent of the magnetic field.
I mean, this is exactly why I don't show the Nusselt number anymore after the magnetic field is switched on. I mean, I only showed you the Nusselt number. Actually, this is only why I showed you the Nusselt number. It's in this plot where there's no magnetic field. So I assume that the director averages out over the whole cell. And it's also not anchored at the top and bottom plate, even if it would be, it doesn't play a big role, but it's not anchored. So and when we apply the magnetic field, I only showed you these numbers which are have a dimension, which are not out of the equations.
Thank you.
I mean, definitely depends on how far you're away from the critical point. If you're very close, then this might be very similar. I don't know how far you were away from the movies you showed, but in the movies you see definitely, I would say, drops. So, and in this case you have definitely, well, not definitely, but you have plumes, right?
It's an interesting question whether one of these funnels, you know, the shadow graph would look like a drop.
Well,
you don't even know whether there's a drop, right? It could be funnel. I mean, I wouldn't know. I mean, one would have to sort the shadow graph to think of and understand whether it's a complex spot you see. So you would have to do a shadow graph. Well, yours is transparent, so it's hard to do. But here's the problem of surface. Here, the surface tension is not existent, right? It's zero. Right.
An important difference between the pneumatic and the. There isn't even an elastic circulation in the energy. Because you saw that he told you about the ground, right? Which is, you know, half the sample's height. And in fact, you know some other measurements.
Yeah, but it was the DLSC.
And all the others, but then you can continue. Okay, well, thank you again for the very nice talks, and I will try to.